She was so busy looking at it that she barely heard Nibiria say, "Nibiria's the third," and very, very quietly, just for her. "Night calves are necro suitcases. Who are you?"
You're listening to Nun Pod with Left Grief, Episode 11, A Convincing Wind. So it is day three on Kanan House, and Gideon Nav is feeling shitty.
"Phrase furious with loneliness" is one that really sticks out for me about like how shitty she's feeling. But we also like talk about a very embodied shitty feeling.
She's also feeling extremely uncomfortable about the super advanced first house skeletons.
Yeah, there's a kind of like almost, it's not house pride and like defensiveness, but there's a kind of like resentment.
I read it as a feeling of kind of surveillance. She's feeling monitored and watched in a way that she doesn't feel like on the ninth. She is feeling really uncomfortable being perceived in this environment.
Yeah, and maybe there's also a piece of uncanny valley happening there too, where if she's used to the movements of skeletons on the ninth being fairly poorly coordinated and, you know, clearly what she would call puppetry, and this feels like real movement, like that's going to activate some of that. Like I'm thinking of that. There's an animated adult movie that has this like striptease in like a silhouette. So it's like a backlit woman, and she takes all of her clothes off, and then she starts like peeling her skin off. And then it's like this skeleton sexy dancing, but they clearly mapped it to like a real person's movement. And so there's a real grace and fluidity to now this skeletal silhouette. And that's unsettling. As it's going over these 2 days, or this like night and day and night, we get a glimpse of Harrow, and one of just two in this, because they're so limited and so brief. This first one is really interesting because it feels like look like it's not much happened in this brief glimpse of Harrow, but the fact that it's included at all, like we know that Mir is a very, it's not a cat, doesn't just casually put things in places. So like, what was Harrow doing that day?
Yeah, the detail that Harrow pauses before Gideon's bed and then just walks away. What is that communicating to us?
Yeah, I know that during the training period prior to getting to the first, like Harrow was doing her thing preparing and Gideon was doing her thing preparing. But it also sounds like prior to that point, like they also had a fairly, like their lives coexisted a lot. Like they had a lot of overlap, and they're going through this period of like not really being engaged with each other's experience. And like it talks about Gideon's loneliness, and you know, maybe this is like that's just Harrow's mirror of that.
It almost suggests maybe some ambivalence on Harrow's part to me, that like she's thinking about including Gideon in her project, but then thinks better of it. It definitely shows that it's not what she says, which is that she never thinks about Gideon. She is thinking about Gideon. She's just not actually reaching out or actually saying anything.
Yeah.
I love the sentence. It was in this abandoned state that the Cavalier of the Ninth House ate two breakfasts, starved of both protein and attention.
Such a, just like, yeah. I've felt that. And then we get this like entrance. And I love every single time Cronabeth is introduced into a scene, it's not just like there's a person in a room. No, there's like, it's Coronabeth Tridentarius. Like that's just the tone of the vibe when she walks into a room. Like when I see this, like I think of a lion with a giant mane. And I'm like, I know that's technically like a boy lion, and like, but I, you know, Coronabeth has this halo of presence and hair that is part of like her scale.
Kira is also later described by drawing analogy between her and a big cat, which I think draws an interesting parallel between Coronabeth and Pyrrha.
There's got to be fan out there for like the houses as various types of dogs, and we know that the ninth house is two cats.
I literally saw, literally saw that art this morning.
But they acknowledge that that Gideon and Hera are cats, right?
Honestly, I was looking for fan art of Babs and I saw the dog AU, decided that it was not appropriate and moved on. So
Sure,
I didn't look
sure.
closely at it.
I do love the dog AUs. They're yeah. So in my mind, if we're going into this one where I have headcanon that Gideon and Harrow are cats, Corona is now a lion. So I'm just seeing this like sulky little ginger cat, like kind of like haphazardly like cleaning its face after eating sulkily on a table, and this lion just like comes in, like totally non-threatening, but also very convincingly because it's a fucking lion.
When I first started cosplaying Coronabeth, somebody that I knew, and that this is going to sound shittier than it is, somebody I knew was like, "Aren't you intimidated by the idea of cosplaying the canonically hottest person in this universe?" And I was like, first of all, no. And second of all, she's not canonically hot. She is canonically attractive to Gideon. We are always seeing her through Gideon's desire for her. And so these over-the-top descriptions of how luminous and beautiful and like that's what it feels like to have a crush on someone. That doesn't actually tell us what she looks like or how hot she is compared to anyone other than Harrow.
I do think that there is a lot of love in the artwork portrayed of her because of this larger than life language. We both very much ascribe to the idea of like she is larger than life and she is a large person, and that is part of like why she's so compelling physically, where you're like, God, fuck, she's just there's so it's like we were looking at some fan art earlier where like she's particularly large, and she's sitting in a position where like her body is all soft and curvaceous, and you get to see all these parts, and we're just like, this is the Corona Beth that like we know we need. But it's also interesting because it challenges and like kind of throws into contrast some of the fatphobic language from earlier on in the book. But I think it kind of maybe is more of a fandom invention, but the language does complement that narrative.
It does. And I strongly support Fat Corona Beth. And also, Mira has said that she strongly supports however people headcanon her characters. She has specifically spoken in favor of Nibirius turn, comma, giant monitor lizard. So she's like, I had a particular thing in my head as I was writing, but you don't have to have that thing. You can have your own thing, which I think, you know, is great. So Coronabeth has arranged this sparring match for all of the Cavaliers, not all of whom take her up on it, but she is personally inviting Gideon, and Gideon does this extremely smitten, nobody could possibly say no to this performance to us, the reader.
And like, I think Muir really wants us to empathize with Gideon in this because like there's like a really specific phrasing in the way that Coronabeth does this, where she roguishly kisses the back of Gideon's knuckles. Now, I think the fact that she says back, not just knuckles, is really like this is the Coronabeth kisses the tender part of the fingers, not the bony knuckles themselves. Which
Is
is close.
that what the back of the neck? What
Well,
do
the
you
front of
mean?
the knuckles would be like,
Oh, I see.
so the back of the knuckles is closer into the wrist, it's closer into the body, it's softer skin. Corona Beth knows all about protocol and detail. She's taking a little bit of an up of the ante to really play up this moment to make this invitation very honestly a little bit overwhelming. I think she knows that presenting it this way is gonna throw Gideon off balance.
I think she's performing a kind of flirting that can happen from femmes toward butches that feminizes the butch,
Yes.
which is often underutilized and can be very powerful.
Yes, as someone who has done so and like very much enjoys what butches do when they are feminized by femmes, like I'm just like, it's so cute. Like they just like blush and kind of crumple and melt, and it is fucking adorable. And so like when Cronabeth does this, I'm just like, strong play. No notes.
Yeah. Coronabeth is doing this very effective. Do you want to be the princess a little bit?
Yeah. I'm just like imagine Gideon's just like there's like regen gen like confusedly reaching her hand forward and like practice Coronabeth is like, come and join my narrative.
This is also
Do it for the
the
plot.
first flirty touch Gideon has ever experienced. No. I guess it's the second, because this is Gideon can count on one hand how many times she has experienced flirty touch. All of them were in the last 3 days. This is
Hormones
some of
are.
the only positive touch she's experienced in her life.
It's honestly amazing that Gideon is still upright and breathing,
Absolutely.
given the amount of gay panic that she is suddenly experiencing.
God's bravest soldier, absolutely.
Bravest. And then she dives right into it. Not, I mean, you could think of it as Cronabeth's eyes, but like, she's just like, well, I have no resistance. She's like thinking all the reasons why. She's like, if no. Like there's, I can just imagine just like, you know, you're having those talks with yourself and you just kind of slowly like slump over in resignation as you're like, okay, now I gotta like put on my game face.
Yeah, I can very strongly relate to the in my defense response that Gideon is portraying here. I too have met
So,
a girl.
so brave. So brave. Coronabeth Tridentarius, First House Social Committee.
I really strongly draw my understanding of Coronabeth from Legally Blonde. In my characterizations of Coronabeth, I draw directly from Elle Woods in that, like, extremely capable, much smarter than she is assumed to be, and also does want to throw a mixer.
Yeah. You know, bimbo as an aesthetic choice. And like this is also a thing that we can recognize is politically strategic for her. This is like what she was raised to do.
Yeah, which I think that there maybe 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, in the last few years, there has been some political bimboism that I think is a really powerful, interesting new feminist strain of saying, like, I am highly sexual, I am unapologetically hot, I am unapologetically feminine, and that does not degrade my value in any way.
Yeah.
And challenging this idea that in order to be respectable, a woman has to be sort of serious and chaste and
Brunette.
unfrivolous, and
Yeah.
this idea of, like, actually, I am just gonna be hot and slutty and as hot and slutty as I want, and I'm gonna be
Yeah.
into the stuff that I'm into, and I still have the full value of a human being because actually, that's fine.
Krona's fantastic representation for that. Because like you know later on in the series her hotness and femininity does not get toned down, it just kind of gets like
It gets
palette swapped.
weirder.
Yeah, it does get weirder and it does get a bit palette swapped.
So throughout this chapter, and as Gideon enters the training room, the first thing we are told about it is that skeletons are cleaning a pit. And it's sort of weird the way Muir keeps coming back to the skeletons, even though Gideon doesn't interact with them at all. We're not really told why it matters. We just keep getting told over and over again in this chapter, the skeletons are cleaning. And we know that Gideon feels weird about the skeletons, and so maybe we're kind of set up not to question it. But the thing that they're cleaning is the pool where the pool scene happens.
The skeletons cleaning is really interesting to me because, like, why didn't they do this before
Why didn't
everyone
they do
got
it
here?
before? And that
Like,
might point to John being just totally impulsive. Although we know that there was a couple of weeks. Maybe they had started cleaning before, but this is as far as they got. It's a big place.
sure. I think there is some kind of clue, interesting thing being said and why this is happening now. Because my other thought was maybe they were like waiting until the rooms started being used to clean them. Like they weren't, like the skeletons weren't going into the rooms until the houses had gone into the rooms.
That's really interesting. Yeah, so it would make sense that they cleaned up the atrium, they cleaned up the kitchen because they were going to use it. They cleaned the specific rooms. So, yeah, it might be that they've started cleaning this room because people have indicated that they plan to use it.
Having watched a lot of period dramas, the scenes of when like an estate is either being like kind of shuttered up or like reopened, there's some iconic things that happen. There's fabric pulled off of furniture and like shutters opened up, and it's a really specific, very energetic montage. But like, yeah, usually the only people in the room who aren't actually doing that task is like one person managing it. Like the fact that everyone is actively in the room here either is saying like this is because the adepts are treated differently. Like if it was the adepts in this room would not be being cleaned currently, or it would have already been cleaned by now. Like given the like media context of this kind of cleaning scene, there's also to me a little bit of a like status between adepts and cavaliers implication, where the fact that things are being cleaned around them means that they are categorically, while the highest ranking, still kind of help.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I had not thought of that. But that makes sense. You wouldn't see in that I'm sort of also drawing from maybe like a Victorian-ish sort of upstairs downstairs
Yeah.
protocol here that yeah, you wouldn't see people cleaning while the family is in the room. You would see
Yeah.
them if they were cleaning and the family started using the room, they would leave and come back
Yeah.
later.
And we do have that example of that one person, which is Corona Bath. She is the ranked person in the room compared to everybody else. She's considered an adept, despite what we do know about later on. Yeah, so that kind of sets up a bit of an interesting power dynamic too when it comes to like she's mediating the duels. Like a lot of this has some class structure implications to it.
It does seem like the rooms are also a little bit separated out. There's like the mirror room and the pool room, and it seems like most of the cleaning is happening in the pool room where the practice session is happening in the mirror room. So
Yeah.
that also gives a little bit of sort of distance from that status
Yeah.
problem.
Yeah.
This is a stone-floored practice room, which is not a choice I would make in designing a practice room.
Aesthetically, I feel like looks cool, but as soon as you start using a stone floor, like it's gonna get slippery or noisy, depending on what you like. Are you in bare feet? Are you wearing shoes? Has anyone put like a sword down? Like, there's all of these like really practical consequences.
I was thinking of it on the level of safety.
Yeah.
This room covered in mirrors, I think of a room like a dance studio, which almost all of the rooms that where I have done indoor sword training, most of my sword training has been outside, but when I have done sword training inside, it's been basically in a basketball court kind of a space where it's wood floors, but if I were to design a training space for swords, I would probably do like a sprung wood floor, like you would have in a dance studio, to make falls a little safer.
Where I did a lot of my training was a space that was renovated and dedicated to martial arts training, and we did have a sprung floor. It wasn't like, like gymnastic sprung floor, but it was designed with impact absorption in mind. And so, but the training that I had had a lot of grappling involved. And cavaliers aren't necessarily grapplers. Like if you're doing, like if you look at training spaces where Olympic duelists are often playing, they have those gymnasium type floors and then very thin mats.
When I did Olympic, we didn't even use mats. We were literally on a basketball court.
Yeah, and so when you have and we see the dueling rules later down the road to touch, like when you have rule sets that don't involve grappling, like yeah, falling is still a concern, but falling is going to be a lot more deprioritized if you're just lunging.
That's true, because when I think about what my concern is with a stone floor, I'm thinking of a kneecap hitting it. And we do have that in this chapter, because that kick to the back of the knee is going to put that knee right on the floor. But in a more Olympic style fencing, you're not going to have a knee strike as much. I mean, ever legally.
I'm like,
And when I say as much.
It is explicitly forbidden. We have another comparison here between the fifth and the third, which we had a couple chapters ago, and we get it really quickly because Magnus is the first person that Cronabeth engages. Magnus is the first one to engage with Gideon. Everyone else in the room is kind of just a bit gawky about it all. So we have this like social setup to this first fight. And then we have the second setup, like, because there's like each of these fights are preceded by like a scene in which the social stakes are set. One of the things that in my training was really thoroughly included was an understanding of the way that violence is social. Because like sport violence within like the context of duels and social violence look a bit different. And we get kind of examples of both here.
When you say social violence, what do you mean?
When violence that specifically aims to either upset or enforce social hierarchy and senses of power and resource, and who controls resources, either perceived or literal. So the most common ways that you see this is the like physical posturing and then leading to low stakes, like grappling and light punching that happens between as like part of like teenage boy hierarchy development. Like this is very stereotypical in that context, but you also see it in cases of like I'm thinking of other ways people are shitty to each other because it's like not a great topic, but like social violence could also look like sabotaging something that involves someone's safety. Like sport violence is under very specific language and rule set, and what is actually considered acceptable behavior and expression of power and skill is very, very described and like, even Gideon is talking about the dueling rule set that she was taught during her training. And then this second scenario, we have a very overstimulated, adrenalized Gideon, a very activated and like chip on his shoulder Nibirius. Like we have two very distinct like setup and description sequences.
I think, we see a lot of characterization of Magnus in this scene. And in the setup to the fight with Gideon, he is having a great time. He is excited. He is kind in the way that he's been kind in the past. He's characterized as looking at her with boyish, teacherly enthusiasm, which is so sweet. And he's perfectly happy to lose. We get this setup earlier, again, with a contrast between him and Nibirius, where he's saying that he's perfectly happy to lose to Jean-Marie, who is his mentee. And he is setting that up as a way of signaling that he is not invested in status as a cavalier. He understands his cavalier role as a function of his marriage rather than something like he's not competing for status on that. And he acknowledges that status is important by affirming Jean-Marie's status. He's like, she is part of a family of high, impressive cavaliers. It's no sweat to lose to her. She's going to be very, very good. And Nibirius finds this disgusting. He's like, you should want status. You should want rank. You should want to be impressive. You should be ashamed to lose. And so we see this incredible contrast between Magnus, who's very happy to be uplifting younger people and other people and competitors, and Nibirius, who is not willing to do that, is not interested in that.
Yeah. It's funny because I think of like people that I've known who fit these archetypes. I love Magnus and like that kind of fighting as a form of connecting and building bonds and creating rapport and bettering each other. Like, love that shit. And it contrasts with Magnus, who like it describes him as like an athlete, like he's chiseled within an inch of his life. Like, you know, I've also met these kind of people who, because they are driving themselves through a certain type of like this craving and needing to enforce status is a very fear-based behavior. And people who are driven by that, like I've seen how athletes who are driven from like a more painful internal place do sometimes way more intense shit because of that motivation and stereotypically, often, you know, marathon runners are cited as a like really easy example of this. Like, to be driven to chisel your body within an inch of its life, like that is actually an incredible amount of work. So Nibirius, we have someone who, like, his time and work, Magnus's time and work is put into creating, like, using this as a tool of connection, using this as a tool of building each other up. And Nibirius is like, I am just going to win. Which is very third house.
Yeah, I think it does point to possible differences in what their experience in their house environment is like, that Magnus enjoys a lot more social security than Nibirius does. But I think it also really highlights the difference in their ages, because Magnus is 38 and Nibirius is 23.
Yeah. I think at 23, I was at LARP putting as many weapons as I could carry into a zillion belts so that I had like a poleaxe and two swords and like six throwing. Like I was like, I'm gonna be so extra and go so hard. So I can kind of and like, you know, now where I'm at in terms of teaching, I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah, I feel this age difference in terms of like you really start caring less about having anything to prove.
Yeah, at 23, I think I was really, really into tourney fighting. So I was doing a lot of one-on-one dueling, and it is really competitive. I was thinking about how do I stack up to other people? How good am I compared to everyone else? You know, in what percentile of the world's fighters do I fight? Like I was comparing myself to literally all other people in my sport. And I was incredibly sensitive to status threats. And now, as I am very nearly Magnus's age, I am much less sensitive to status threat and much more comfortable and confident in my social standing, and much more comfortable uplifting others and directing credit, especially to people who are much younger than me.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a sense too, and I think we share this where like that is in fact front and center in some of our decision making in our lives.
Totally.
Because that has been front and center in terms of the way that Magnus has interacted with Gideon multiple times now.
Yeah, and Magnus is, at least to his understanding, I think the oldest person here. And so it's very natural for him to fall into the dad friend role. And that's not what Nibirius is about. Nibirius is here to win. He is here with Ianthe, who is here to win.
I'm just like, okay, I putting the wish out there for fandom content. What I want is like, so we have the storyline of Gideon the Ninth, but what I want is cosplayers doing like behind the scenes confessionals, like after each chapter.
Oh my God, I want that so bad.
I'm here to win. Ianthe's here to win. Cronabeth's here.
I want that so bad.
If anyone wants, I would put my time behind this if other people want to play this game with me. Because like
Yeah.
even like teacher or a fucking skeleton.
Claire, I want this so bad.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So bad.
I would watch any number of hours of this.
All right, so they are here with very different relationships to what they think the point of them being here is.
Yes, they're bringing very different vibes, and the way that the fight goes is really different, partially because of the vibes, and partially because, as you mentioned, Gideon goes into the first fight lonely and sort of having that physical urge to move that characterizes her experience of being bored. And she goes into the second fight adrenalized and off guard, and knowing that Nibirius is absolutely coming for her throat. Like, he is actively fucking with her, and she knows it.
And she also, like, for both of them, calculates their skill level very fast.
Yeah, which we saw her do in the fight with Harrow in, was it chapter two or three, where she knows instantly how the fight is going to end, which I feel like this chapter is so full, as you've talked about before, with that evidence of Muir sitting down with experienced sword fighters and really getting a phenomenologically rich understanding of what it's like, not just to have a sword, but like what it's like to experience sword fighting
Yeah,
as a very
yeah.
experienced and skilled fighter.
And in regards to the language that Muir chose to use to describe these fights, I think it's really fascinating that there is no mention of footwork. And I love this. Like, as someone who was trained in rapier, footwork was a big part of how I think about movement. If you look at these classic manuals, footwork is not necessarily always a clearly indicated thing. Sometimes it is really explicitly indicated, and sometimes, like, there's not a consistent way to be able to read it. And so part of it is theorizing how would my body move to make the swords happen this way. And so what Muir is doing is focusing on what is the swords happening, because that is a really immediate thing. It talks about the relationship between body and blade, and that is the relationship the language is focused on.
Yeah, and that
Their
relationship
footwork's not
between
part of it until Gideon's boot is involved. And now we have this totally different view of the fight. Like, so it's going from this very, like, only talking about, like, the language shifts. And it's like, yeah, because in fencing and dueling, like, kicking people is not a thing. Like, you don't, but the footwork, like, is how you get to the position of being able to execute the move. Or the footwork is like your body positioning with them is how you evaluate what options you have.
And I know this is also a difference between how you were trained and how I was trained, because in the sport that I played, kicking was not allowed because it was dangerous. And I know that you have gotten to play with some kicking.
Yeah, because the training that I had was fencing, boxing, and grappling as a like holistic system, knowing how those three pieces also related to each other was part of my training. And looking at someone who would be trained to be a duelist, like even looking at like an Olympic fencer versus my training today, like an Olympic fencer would have a hard time doing what Gideon did. I wouldn't. But yeah, at the end of the day, like I love the language that Muir chose to use. Because it really stays focused on where the energy is being exchanged. And I've read some really great fights, like Joseph Brassey's Skyfarer has some really fantastic fights in it. Joe is also a coach, so his fights also talk about how they're longsword fights, and they talk about how footwork is used in that. And I think. I suspect, I can't explicitly remember, but I suspect we will see more mention of footwork as Gideon gets her own sword out.
Yeah, I was thinking that the footwork wasn't visible to her because the footwork in the fight with Magnus, she's really in a flow state. She is like, time has slowed down. She is vibing. She can cue instantly on what he's doing and she's totally comfortable with it. Whereas in the fight with Nibirius, she's activated, she's adrenalized, she's tense. She's still cueing immediately, but she's getting very different readings
Yeah.
from that. And so I kind of imagined it as she's not thinking about her footwork with Magnus because she's so relaxed, she doesn't need to. And she's not thinking about her footwork with Nibirius because she's so tense that she can't.
Sure. That's totally plausible and relatable. And I also think about like she is more focused on their technique than their feet. as well. You know, it talks about she, you know, like stops thinking with her head and starts thinking with her sword. And that's a very literal sensation, kind of when you get into that headspace. And that is also, you know, like when I say that's the point where the energy in the relationship is being exchanged, it's really quite literal.
Yeah, there is, and I mean, part of the point of drilling, as I understand it, is to build that muscle memory so that your body can make the decision even before you recognize. And a lot of fighters will talk about sensing that they have started to take the shot before they register it consciously, that their body knows what the opening looks like and will just go. And there's this feeling of sort of surrender to the body in the fight that it's just happening. And it feels like it's happening sort of without you.
The best way I ever kind of heard it described is that, like, if you imagine yourself in a, like a soap bubble. And there's you and someone else's. And like you can feel the pressure when your soap bubbles come in contact. And they don't necessarily pop, but you can feel the way that theirs presses against yours, and you can manipulate that as well. And there's inertia and directionality and speed and acceleration happening in that relationship of those bubbles interacting with each other. And this happens in many dimensions. Like with real bubbles, that you're going to have a flat surface because they're equal pressure. But here we're talking about something that is the shape of a body. And we, with our senses of proximity to other people, have an inherent like reaction to when that changes in one way or another. If someone's hand gets close to our hand, if someone's head gets close to our head, and we can train those responses to be a desired movement.
Yeah, there's this line where in the fight with Magnus, Gideon describes his dagger coming to a certain place like they had agreed beforehand where it would fall. And it can feel choreographed in that way when you're really in the zone and the fight is going well.
Yeah, I was in a tournament once where I just happened to realize that there was one shot that I had been trained in that nobody here knew. And I got every single one of my wins on this one shot, and they all felt the same. And I was just like, I'm just gonna sit here and wait and then go. Like, and when there's a kind of clarity that happens in that, that this like sensation of Gideon like dropping out of her mind and into her body, and there's a kind of like, yeah, fluidity that happens in that moment is it's very tactile. Like it's a feeling. Like you'll sometimes get goosebumps, or like your nervous system will change.
Also, a lot of the people reacting to this fight with Magnus are really impressed at her speed, and it's clear that she's much faster than they expected her to be, which is a thing that I also got to experience when I switched from 2-inch rattan to rapier. Because when you are used to fighting with a heavier sword, a light sword goes really fast. And some people
Yes.
even train in the pool in order to train for speed. Because when you're used to training in a hampered environment, then when you're unhampered, you are so quick.
And this is the same kind of training concept as why like Olympic athletes will go to like high altitude, low oxygenated environments and train there 6 months prior to their competitions, so that when they go back to lower elevations that have higher oxygen concentrations, their hemoglobin levels have been all souped up and they're going to be running on extra juice that they don't normally have access to in a totally like natural, just body adapting to different environments way.
And Gideon might be getting that boost as well because she's used to a fairly thin atmosphere that's pumped in, and this is a sea level Earth atmosphere environment. She is
Shit,
so full of
yeah.
oxygen.
She's high. Yeah, which would probably mean that like, you know, this is going into the Nibirius fight, the most adrenalized she's been since she's been here. So if she's like experiencing a lot of physiological changes because of all the difference in like what her body is experiencing day to day, like this adrenaline rush is also going to be really intense. It talks about how this level of overstimulation is actually quite extraordinary for her.
Yeah, so let's talk about how adrenaline and being in that highly adrenalized state changes how your brain works during a fight.
So you lose a lot of what you would consider like decision making, decision evaluating capability. You can make decisions, but you can't really evaluate them. It's much harder to recognize how much information you aren't taking in. You really lose the ability to contextualize yourself in a larger environment.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. In contrast, the flow state feels like you can see everything. Sometimes it even feels like you're witnessing it from the outside and you can see all the different I've heard people in melee environments talk about seeing shots that other people can take while also adequately managing their own encounter,
It's
where it feels like you
great.
can see the entire field at once and you're like, I see what this fight is doing and I can see what my fight is doing and I can see what her fight is doing and we're all moving in slow motion and it just feels this like relaxed, empowered. And in contrast, that adrenalized state is tunnel vision and you're only seeing a tiny part of even your own fight and it there can be a terror, but there can also just be sort of an urgency and that feeling of being forced, that feeling of not having choices. And in both, it can feel like you're taking actions without really choosing them, but in one way, it feels very natural and graceful and controlled and calm, and in the other, it feels bad.
I've been in fights I wanted to be in, and I've been in fights I didn't want to be in, and I've been in fights that I tried to not be in, but they decided that it was going to be a fight. And the differences between those things are, once you're able to register them, like really quite trainable. And like knowing Eglemine had a history with like what I assume to be military service, she would know that. And I'm at, it sounds like Gideon's early training focused more on those like unpredictable, brawly, fighty scenarios where the likelihood of that adrenalization is much higher. And so training to accommodate that, training to make that muscle memory like so automatic that it's like the first thing you reach for versus this like flow state where you're kind of almost like exploring as you go and discovering as you go. Like that would have been that 3 months was like, here's a bit of like predictable pattern that you can like start to draw in. Like Gideon's fighting in her second fight is actually like really shows what she's capable of.
Yeah, she in her fight with Magnus, she knows that she's going to win. She describes it as her fight to lose. And so all she has to do is not fuck up. And so she's able to very elegantly get his threat out of the way and let him know that the fight has ended. And this is not the situation she's in with Nibirius.
Yeah, elegance is very much something that you only get as an option if you have a lot of control over the situation.
We don't get a lot of description of how Magnus fights, other than, inadequately against Gideon. He could be perfectly fine. He can't compete with her speed and her precision. But we get very detailed description of Nibirius as clean and like clockwork, inevitable, bloodless, perfect, with absolute economy of movement. And that is extreme skill and practice.
And I delighted in hearing about some of the techniques used because Mir got really specific. And I know what style Nibirius's training is referenced in. And the fun thing about that is it tells me about his footwork. Because this, so it's talk, when it talks about this like semicircle, there's a style written by a guy called Destreza. I think he was a Spaniard. And circles are relevant both in terms of blade work and footwork. You are using 45 degree angles and a circling pattern to create increasing amounts of distance and orient yourself around to the side and back of your opponent. So that's how you control your body. And so it's really infuriating because it's hard for them to access you. And it also puts you in really good positions for strong disarms with this particular technique where you are basically spiraling your blade around their blade until it starts to lock out on them. And then at that point, when you've kind of built up that tension and they can't accommodate that spiral anymore, it's quite easy to do a disarm, which is infuriating to fight.
I thought it was really interesting while we're on the topic of destreza. There are several references to fighting manuals in this chapter, which are interestingly in contrast to a later conversation with the sixth about fighting manuals. And I had remembered that second conversation, but I had forgotten this one. And so it was very exciting to see. There's I think three different references in this chapter. One that says that Nibirius's footwork is like a manual had been fed directly into his feet. There's a comment that, it seems like he ate up the manuals and chewed a million times. And there's an annoyed joke in Gideon's head that, his perfect footwork was probably recorded in some manual with stupid names. And to contextualize, fighting manuals are a fascinating historical artifact that arose, and correct me if I'm wrong here, late medieval, early Renaissance kind of era.
A lot of the ones that are really widely studied right now, to my knowledge, are from there, but we have examples like as early as the 10th century
Oh, wow. So I was
that
familiar.
I'm familiar with. There may be even earlier examples, but I think Agrippa's wrestling manual from the
Okay, sure.
900s, which I think also includes some sword and buckler type stuff, is I think the earliest one that I know of.
One of the things that I find really interesting about these sword manuals is they were often produced by a sword master for a wealthy patron who was not going to do actual sword fighting at any kind of level. And so there are questions about accuracy. It's not clear that a lot of these techniques were ever practical or used, and some of them seem to be, and some of them seem to be more theatrical to amuse the wealthy patron. And so trying to recreate combat skills from these manuals has this really fun open question of what was real, in the same way that dress historians have recreating from paintings. Because yes, it is a period representation, but it's not clear how realistic it was ever even intended to be.
And similarly to how art historians manage to try and interpret meaning more precisely, they use, historical context, relationship between the creators, relationship between the materials used. Because, like, sometimes you get situations where you have a post-warring period and you have a bunch of really skilled fighters, and that becomes a collective body of knowledge that's then encoded. And then that body of knowledge is then re-engaged with during peacetime in different ways. And so each of the people writing and each of the people commissioning have their own unique context that kind of help provide a few little clues around that. And sometimes also within the manuals themselves, what they include can also give hints on that. Like you sometimes have ones that are competitive between two sword masters who are specifically, aiming to defeat each other's style because they're contemporaries from rivaling countries. The one that I study has a lot of non-lethal disarming and grappling techniques. It focuses on a lot more like possible day-to-day actual interactions rather than ones that would be more in a sport-controlled environment. So there's these different hints, but at the same time, that filter of what was the desire of this noble in commissioning this? Like, was this a vanity piece? Were they an enthusiast? Like, are they, trying to preserve cultural knowledge from like they're proud of now being the leader of a peacetime state? Like, there's all these little hints that, like, would be just as much true for these theoretical cavalier manuals. And then you also have the ones that are explicitly military. So a lot of so we have these earlier ones, which often, because we didn't have printing presses, were not often, they were exclusively hand transcribed prior to printing presses. But once we had printing presses and were able to like more widely make manuals and documentation of fighting styles, the military were like, cool, we're going to start colonizing and establishing territories and redrawing borders again, and we're going to standardize our military training and scale it up. So now you start to get traditions going from where they were in this more sport and socially relevant. Like there was always swords in military practice, but it starts to be more codified later on. So the manuals start being less specifically about like these relationships to nobles or a particular style or piece of history, and more of a like strategy of a government. The ninth, the, sorry, the third is an aesthetic house. They are a house of propaganda. They are a house of performance. They're the manuals that Nibirius would have, that would have been rooted in the third, would have to do with exactly what you're describing, where there is a lot of status and imagery and portrayal of power in the styles that are funded, enforced, and like.
At the same time, he is not doing flourishes. He is minimalist. He is clean and surgical.
Absolutely.
It's interesting to me that Gideon is aware of manuals and knows enough about them to know that there are things like two crows drinking water as the name of a move. But it's very clear that her training was not directly manualized. It's probable, it seems like, that her training from Aglamine would be informed by Aglamine's knowledge of these manuals, but Gideon has never read them herself, or if she's encountered them, it's maybe in passing in the Ninth Library rather than a sort of deep study. Because she's not saying, I recognize the footwork as from this manual. She's saying, I recognize the footwork as the kind of thing that would be in one of these kind of manuals.
Yeah, and there is visible movement differences in you know our world's training, where there are like modern day manuals and guides on this is how it goes versus people who are trained in a more improvisational sparring environment. Like cleanness often comes from like a lot of repetition. Yeah, you can tell how someone trains sometimes by how they fight.
But I think as much as Gideon recognized that Nibirius is fighting by the book, Nibirius is also explicitly recognized that Gideon isn't, and he doesn't have any respect for non-manualized fighting style.
Yeah, absolutely. And which what makes really clear early on with the his reaction to the knuckle knives. He is coming into this fight with something to prove to the rest of the room about who he thinks Gideon is. Putting myself in Gideon's shoes, like still in that headspace of I have to follow the rules. Gideon could fuck up Nibirius right now with those knuckle knives. Real bad, real fast. And she doesn't. She explicitly does not engage her offhand at all in this perfect opportunity to do so. She's not breaking the rules.
Going back
Like,
to our first conversation about knuckle knives, Corona makes a comment on seeing them that they are tremendously nasty, and she says it in a voice that Gideon finds super hot, and I think Corona maybe also finds the idea of this really nasty weapon hot, and I just love that, and I love that about Corona.
and this also tells us that like Corona enjoys tormenting Nibirius. She is putting him in at like she trusts his capacity. She says she's the hardest on him of anyone, which I believe is true. I think she, like Ianthe, enjoys his suffering. And like the idea of putting him in actual danger with this obviously skilled fighter who's using a fairly nasty weapon is really amusing to her. Like, yeah, he kind of like begs it out of her, but like this is dangerous. It is, in fact, knuckle knives are not a really sparring complementary weapon. It's really hard to scale back on fucking glass.
Yeah, she is willing to put him in that position.
Yeah, and Gideon chooses not to take this opportunity to rip his fucking face off or his guts open, whatever. Like, it is not until she is disarmed that and he is like starting to gloat that she's like, fuck it. Because I think it's when he gloats that she engages with the actual social stakes that she has in this situation. Because she's like, I'm just the Ninth Cavalier, I'm silent, I'm following the rules, I'm doing the duelies. And like now Nibirius is like, you're a piece of scum and I'm right about it. And like you just embarrassed yourself because I disarmed you. Like there's just now it's Gideon, like there's this line that happens. So Gideon's adrenalized, and then at that point, that disarm, with Nibirius's like criticism, unsolicited criticism of Gideon's fighting, like I have seen red. I know, like, and it's an interesting situation when you go from a sport fight to saying like, I actually need to hurt this person. Like, normally, I think when Gideon's this adrenalized, she's dealing with Harrow or Crux. Being able to salvage that situation is really impressive, and is and it quickly takes the fact that Nibirius put really high social stakes on this, and then part of the social contract here is a mutual respect. As soon as Nibirius makes this public audible comment, Gideon's like, all bets are off.
Yeah, and you've talked before about how a fight is a communication, and Nibirius is saying, within the confines of this highly structured sport combat, I am better than you. And Gideon's response is, I could kill you right now.
Which feel like that falls under the category of good for her. Good for her. And then we see Jean Marie's response, which is exactly what teenage me would say.
Yeah, Jean-Marie is like, I want to do that one. I'm not interested in his thing. I am
Yeah,
very
yeah.
clear on which of these is the thing that I want for myself.
Yeah.
And Dias also is like, yeah, that's it. That's the one. Babs is super pissed because everybody then responds positively
Yeah.
to Gideon rather than him. So he won the fight, but he doesn't get the status.
Yeah, he upped the ante and Gideon won the pot.
We don't know yet that Isaac and Jean-Marie have already tried to enlist in the military. And we know that Gideon tried to start enlisting in the military when she was very young, but I think it hasn't hit us yet as readers at this point that child soldiers are just a normal part of the Empire because Gideon's
Oh.
escape attempts were unrealistic in a way. Like it didn't feel like, oh, this is a real thing that she can do. It feels like this is a thing that she as a child is trying to do. I think the way that I read this scene on First Contact was that Jean-Marie was being prepared for a future military role that was maybe like far in the future. And looking at the relationship and the mentorship between Magnus and Jean-Marie, having the later awareness that child soldiers are just part of the plan really brings up questions that complicate his sweet, wholesome dad friend vibe. That what is his role in reproducing and preparing her for being a child soldier?
Yeah, and I think that kind of question is one that, like, as you reread the books, starts to come up, where it's like Gideon and Harrow, both as our protagonists, are leveraging trying to access power through the Empire. Like, they are all trying to be part of it, of continuing to forward this system, in fact, in a pretty drastic way, in a way that's only ever happened once before at this moment. But like also we have examples how they're all embedded in the long-term cogs of keeping this machine going forward. And all pretty unquestioningly.
Yeah,
You know?
Gideon is concerned about fascism, but she's still down.
Yeah. Even our like we're supposed to perceive Gideon as one of these, like, heart of gold himbo types, but like, still down.
And she isn't disgusted or disturbed to see teenagers. She is threatened to see, like, her response is that teenagers are awful, which is an interesting contrast to, as we've, I think, mentioned before, the later response by Mercy Morn that inviting teenagers to this process was disgusting.
In a previous episode, we talked with Caro, who has done cosplays, and we are all of similar ages. And we talked about that interesting thing when there's like larger and larger age gaps within people of commonality, your understanding of what is safe and what is appropriate evolves over time in a way that like you look at what you thought was fine and normal, and you're like, well, I guess I'm going to take a little bit of responsibility for trying to make that better because fuck.
Yeah. And I think at 18, I wanted to join the military. And I decided to go to college first so that I could become an officer and be a military, like, do I was gonna do career military intelligence, and thank God I became too disabled to be qualified for the US Army. But
Wow.
yeah,
Yeah.
I graduated high school at 17. I went through the Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, which is a ch children's military training program that the United States does. And then I decided, rather than enlisting at 17, which is legal in the United States, I would go to college first and enter and do officer training. And I wanted to be a linguist. I was going to do really bad things to the Middle East. It's so good that I didn't become an army linguist. Holy shit.
Yeah,
Anyway.
it's great. It's great that you didn't. I'm really thrilled of that for you and the Middle East. That's funny. Mine was like, I kind of wanted to join a nunnery, and then went to Bible college right out of high school.
It's
Not quite
probably good that
succeeded.
we never did Griddle Hark.
Well, there's an inversion I've never pictured before. So we have two sightings of Hera in this chapter. One is very early on, and we spoke about how it reflects the fact that like while Hera is not including Gideon in her plans, like she is considering Gideon in her process. Like she has paused to note where Gideon is, what Gideon's doing. She would have no reason to come to the gymnasium. This is not a place that like she has any can get any benefit from spending time in, and why would she be here except to check in on Gideon?
And the other Cavaliers.
And the other Cavaliers, yeah, sizing up the other houses. And noticing that Coronabeth is here is also something that
She
she
is
picks up
not
on.
knowledgeable about swords in the way that Gideon is knowledgeable about skeletons.
That's true.
So she might not actually get that much out of watching a fight. She can hear what other people have to say in commentary about the fight, and she can see who wins.
Yeah. And like how they're having to respond to that. 'Cause it kind of positions her as a cross, like on the other side of the pool almost.
So she's way on the other side of the space,
Yeah.
observing, and her face is totally obscured by her hood and her paint, and of course the distance. So Gideon can't tell exactly what she's thinking,
Nope.
but is very uncomfortable to be observed by Harrow at this moment.
We're not aware of how long Gideon Harrow has been there. Presumably, she didn't just arrive.
Yeah.
She didn't just like come in, clock Gideon, and turn around, and Gideon just happened to see her at the same second. Like she's been there for at least some amount of time.
I would expect that she would want the same thing that Palamedes wants, which is not to show anyone how good her calf is.
Yeah, and the other thing is that like not to show anyone how unorthodox her calf is.
Certainly. So our general process for choosing art for our episodes is either we know in advance that we want to use a particular cosplay from ourselves or one of our friends or our guest, ideally, if we're having a guest, or we have to go looking for something that fits. And that has forced us to do focused fan art searches, which I think has brought some joy to my life, and I hope also to yours.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But this week, we had a couple of different ideas for what we could feature as our cover art, and nothing quite hit where we wanted.
So we were just like, what if we made our own? Because you get really specific on how you like visualize some of these things.
Yeah. And this comes from a heart crime that I've had saved in my TikTok sounds folder for probably 5 years. But my wife won't let me cosplay with Jean-Marie and Isaac. So I haven't been able to use this sound, which is Do It For Her from Steven Universe. And I think that it would be really beautiful to represent this song as the relationship between Magnus and Jean-Marie. But it's really hard to ask someone, particularly someone really young looking, if they will play the role of Jean-Marie or Isaac. It feels mean.
Those poor kids have it real rough.
Yeah.
Poor babies. So we decided that we wanted to make a little special heart crime for this episode's cover art.
Because we're monsters.
Just like you.
Nun Pod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Kaley and edited by Han Kaley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. With apologies to Rebecca Sugar, we made today's cover art specifically for this episode. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.